The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. All right, everybody. How do you do it? C-O-L-T-S, Colts, before they stole them. The music you're hearing is the Colts Marching Band, and we're going to talk today about what has been voted in many polls as the best game ever played, the 1958 NFL Championship between the Baltimore Colts and New York Giants. Many books have been written about this, have come out in the last few months, because it's the 40th anniversary of that game.
50th.
50th. Did I say 40? I can't count. I don't want to be that old yet. Michael Esker, columnist for a long time here in Baltimore City, first for the Sun, now for the Examiner. I must have full disclosure here that Michael Esker is a dear, dear old friend, who is a good, dear friend of mine who always has my back and has always been a buddy. But he wrote this great book, The Colts Baltimore, A City and Its Love Affair in the 1950s. And it's more than about the game. It's about what the city was like 50 years ago. So, Michael, good to have you in the studio.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to see you here.
It is 50 years, and how is that possible?
How is that possible?
But, you know, when we were kids, you know, in 1958, if somebody had talked to us about what happened half a century in Baltimore, it would have been the old Orioles, you know, back in Wee Willie Keeler, and we would have said, what's that? So it's hard to imagine what people today think when we're talking about a football team 50 years ago. Why should they care? Why should they remember? Because that 58 game, really created the modern National Football League, and that game gave Baltimore such a sense of pride in itself. And also, you know, at the turn of the century, ESPN did a survey of the greatest sporting events of all time, baseball, mm-hmm. football, whatever. Mm-hmm. The 1958 Colts-Giants game was voted the greatest sports moment in history. Baseball, football, courts, whatever, the greatest moment.
Why do you think that is?
The drama was unbelievable. And it took us out of the sleepy Eisenhower years into you know, where baseball was the national pastime, and suddenly here was this game that was so fast and so exciting that it just changed everything. It speeded up the country's metabolism.
Michael Esker's with us. Join us here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And if you are one of the old heads, remember that game? Remember Baltimore in the 50s, whatever neighborhood you lived in, on the west side, in Greektown, Highland Town, whatever part of town you lived in. Join us here with your thoughts and remembrance of that period of time in our history. And maybe you just don't know that period and want to talk about the stories that you've heard. 410-319-8888. Baltimore, 1958. Now, your book is as much about the city as it is about the game that took place. Yeah. It's all.
There have been books written about the game, and there are books out now about the game. I don't know how many. Last I heard, there were 23 books that have been written about the game.
Really? 23 books?
And I don't know how many different ways you can describe a football being thrown through the air. So I wanted to write about the great cast of characters that existed on the Colts: John Unitas, Lenny Moore, Artie Donovan, Big Daddy Lipscomb, that whole great cast, as well as the cast of characters in Baltimore, from Mayor Tommy D'Alessandro and Buddy Dean and Miss Nancy on Romper Room, you know, Mimi DiPietro, who later became a city councilman, but back then was a rising young bookmaker. you know, the great characters, and also what it was like in Baltimore back then, in that these were the post-war years. And Baltimore was beginning to see itself slipping. The jobs were going away in the steel mills and the factories. People were moving to the suburbs. We were adjusting racially. You know, 1954, Brown versus Board of Education said we're going to have public schools that really are for the entire public. Baltimore was adjusting to this in profound ways. And we had Major League Baseball had just arrived. The Orioles were, with one or two exceptions, were essentially a segregated team in the 1950s. They had a first baseman, Bob Boyd, who was terrific, who played here for a couple of years. They had a pitcher, Connie Johnson, who was terrific, played for a couple of years. And that was about it, a couple of reserve outfielders. But for a 5-6 year period through the 1950s, it was an all-white team other than that. And here were the Colts.
And they were also a terrible team.
Yes, and they were a terrible team. And the Colts were pretty bad, too, the first few years of their existence. And then they started to get better, and also they began to bring in black players. And who did they bring in? They brought in Lenny Moore. They brought in Jim Parker, Big Daddy Lipscomb, Leonard Lyles, people whose names became part of our household vocabulary. And we watched at a very delicate time in our history where we wondered, how are we going to work things out racially? Can we really? We're looking at the public schools where people were wondering, can we work it out there? This was all brand new. And here we are looking at the Baltimore Colts, these tough, brawny guys. And look at this. They're making it work. They're making it work. Unitas drops into the pocket, protected by Jim Parker. Big Daddy makes a tackle alongside Gino and Artie. Black and white working together. If these guys could make it work, Unitas pitching to Lenny, who runs away from everybody, if they could make it work, nobody made speeches about it. But we were watching, and we saw them embracing on the field, and we saw their pictures together in the morning paper the day after a game.
In a still segregated city.
Yes, very much. This was a lesson.
And Baltimore was in, we'll get to that too. Baltimore is like a city of neighborhoods. There's some people called in. There's somebody on the road here. Let's get them on the air before he leaves the road. 410-319-8888. Michael Lesker's in the studio. His book, The Colts Baltimore, A City and a Love Affair in the 1950s, about Baltimore 1958, about the most important sports game ever played, many people say, the New York Giants versus the Baltimore Colts in December of 1958. 410-319-8888. Raymond on the road, you're on the air.
Yes.
Hi, Raymond, you're on the air.
Oh, great. Yes, I was 11 years old when that game was played, and I remember it was a Sunday afternoon, and it was very cloudy, and my mother had made a banana pudding, and I was sitting in a chair listening to that game. It was my first game that I actually paid attention to football, and I was just glued to the sit. I didn't even get up to go to the bathroom. I was so excited about that game. And when Steve Myra kicked that field goal, I nearly leaped out of my chair.
So did Steve Myra.
He was the kicker for the Colts at that time.
And he kicked with 7 seconds left to play.
Yes, he sure did. And I was so excited. And Johnny Unitas, every time he threw the ball to Raymond Berry or Lenny Moore, I would yell, "He's got it!" And then Vince Berry yelled, "And Raymond Berry's got him at the sidelines and goes out of bounds."
He was doing Chuck Thompson in his living room.
Yeah. It was just great.
Thank you.
That was my game.
And what part of town did you live in?
I lived in Northwest Baltimore. I lived on Larman Street, right off Fulton Avenue at that time.
Oh, yes, right.
And I was going to the Maryland School for the Blind.
Uh-huh.
And we got Colt footballs and Colt caps. Everything was Colt jackets. We just had a ball those years.
Now, isn't it something, it's 50 years later, and you can still recall vividly what it was like back then?
Oh, yes. I remember it was raining, and it was very cloudy. And cold.
Raymond, thanks so much. Great. I'm glad you called in.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, and we have an email here I'm going to read that actually came from New York. It wrote to steinershow@gmail.com or call us here at 410-319-8888. We're talking about Baltimore in the 1950s. And the great game that was played between the Colts and the Giants in the book by Michael Lesker, The Colts Baltimore. Steve writes in those days before football became the dominant TV show that it is today, there would be a local television blackout because the owners feared they wouldn't be able to sell out the stadiums if the public could watch for free. Go figure. So I had to listen to the game on radio. And believe me, the Giants weren't the only ones to suffer sudden death. As an 11-year-old, I did as well. I guess it's what made the Giants win over the Patriots last year so satisfying. It's great to pass the heartache on down the line to someone else. I hated the Colts for years, especially Johnny Unitas. He was just so good. Till Super Bowl III. says Steve in New York City.
That wasn't Unitas' fault, and the less we spend talking about Super Bowl III, the better. You know, the previous caller talked about that final drive with Myra kicking the field goal. You know, today the teams go up and down the field like Patton's Army. But in those days, there was nobody ever heard of a two-minute drill back then. The teams were still diving into the line 3 yards in a cloud of dust. And here it is. Let me just recap a little bit for so many listeners who weren't alive back then, like you and me, Mark.
You were older than me. Always have been.
A year, yeah, that's right. But there they were. We were down. The Colts were down 17-14. The Giants punt. The Colts get the ball on their own 14-yard line with under 2 minutes to go. Unitas throws incomplete two in a row. It's now 3rd and 10. They're 86 yards away. You can't even see the other goal line. Twilight is falling. It's freezing cold. The wind is blowing. The fans are screaming their lungs out. And on 3rd and 10, Unitas finds Lenny Moore for 11 yards and a first down. Then hits three in a row to Raymond Berry. And with 7 seconds left, here comes Steve Myra onto the field. And one of the great joys for me of doing the book was going back and talking to people like Artie Donovan, Lenny Moore, Andy Nelson, who was not only on the team back then, but was Steve Myra's roommate. And he said everybody on the team knew Steve Myra was the most nervous guy in the world. And here he is going out with 7 seconds left. And Artie Donovan talked about how he and Jim Parker are running out onto the field to block for this final field goal with 7 seconds left. And, you know, you think these are professionals, wonder what's going on.
And big guys.
Big, tough guys. And he said they're running out on their field, and Parker is yelling, "I'm scared, I'm scared." And Donovan's yelling, "Shut up, shut up." You know, you can't picture this when you're watching it, but they were just as scared as we were.
And they won.
And then, of course, Myra kicked the tying field goal, and in overtime. No one had ever seen an overtime game before this. Some of the players started walking off the field. They thought the game was over and ended in a tie. And their own coaches said, "Where are you going?" "Well, the game's over. A tie." No, stay. We're playing sudden death. They didn't know what they were talking about.
Now, let's describe some of the players from that time. One of the things is that there's a great piece in your book here that I think it was Lenny Moore. And he's talking to Melvin Laird, is it? The Brian Laird? The
Bruce Laird.
Bruce Laird. Bruce,
yes.
Laird, who had been on my show before. I should remember his name. Who had played in the Colts in the 70s.
Mel Laird was the Secretary of Defense under Nixon.
That's right. Oh, God. It's a better Laird.
Yes. Different guy.
Different guy. But they talked about why the game was so much tougher on the players in many ways.
They understand now that the quarterback is the marquee player, and the fans want to see a wide-open passing game, and they don't want to see these quarterbacks get injured. Back then, I mean, Lenny Moore was talking about how every play the defensive team came gunning for Unitas, and they would hit him after the play, during the play. One of the great stories, this wasn't in the 58 season, it was 2 years later, they're playing the Bears in Chicago. The Bears back then were known as the Monsters of the Midway. And they came at you to break your legs and anything else. And it's now, they're down to the last 20 or 30 seconds of the game. The Colts are down by 4 points. And Doug Atkins of the Bears comes in and smashes Unitas' nose wide open and breaks his teeth. And the Colts call timeout. And Weeb Eubank, the coach, comes out on the field and says, "I'm taking you out of the game." And Unitas said, "You do, and I'll kill you." And they could not stop the blood from gushing from Unitas' nose. And Alex Sandusky, an offensive guard, finally reaches down and grabs a clump full of mud and shoves it up Unitas' nose to stop the bleeding. And on the last play of the game, Unitas throws the bomb, and Lenny Moore catches it in the end zone to beat the Bears. I mean, that's the kind of devastation. These guys killed each other week in and week out.
Let me read from your book.
Yeah.
This is talking about the toughness of the game back in 1958. And he's talking about Lenny Moore, one of the great halfbacks of all time.
Hall of Famer.
Hall of Famer. Back when there's another part of your book where they say the three greatest football players of that era were Lenny Moore, Johnny Unitas, our quarterback, and Jim Brown. One of the greatest field players ever in football.
Jim Brown was the great fullback of the Cleveland Browns, yes.
So he says he mulled that over for a moment. Quote, "But the toughness," Moore said, That's the thing nobody will ever understand, end quote. He came back to it another time. He was sitting with Barry and Mutchler one afternoon, two other Colts, and Bruce Laird, the guy whose name I couldn't remember. Laird was a defensive back for the Colts in the 70s, a real good one. It was the 50th anniversary of United States' entrance into the game, and Tom Callahan's book, Johnny U, had just come out, so they were talking about the era. Was the play dirtier in your day, somebody asked. Oh, my, said Moore. They could beat you till the whistle blew. Come here, Brucey. Laird and Moore got up on their chairs. Moore was past 70. Laird was 20 years younger. Moore fainted his way left and right. I still can't cover you, Laird said. In our era, said Moore, I'm fighting off these blows. He gestures, lifting Laird's arm as though a defender was throwing a forearm to his throat. See, they can't do that now. Darn it, said Laird, that must have been a good time.
Yes. Yeah, they just went after each other ferociously. I once asked Artie Donovan, who was the toughest?
And Artie Donovan was, for those who don't know,
the great Hall of Fame defensive tackle on the Colts.
And a Brooklyn Irish boy. Brooklyn,
Bronx,
New York.
The Bronx.
Bronx.
Yes. And Artie, I said, who was the toughest of all those guys? And I figured he'd say, you know, Gino Marchetti, Big Daddy Lipscomb, Don Joyce, who wrestled in the offseason. And he said, Unitas. He said, because he took the most punishment.
And he was a skinny guy.
He was a skinny guy, yeah. He took the most punishment.
Let's talk a bit about Baltimore in 1958, because your book, we're going to come back to the football part, but this book, The Colts Baltimore by Michael Esker, is really about the city and what it was like in 1958. And those of you who remember, join us here a bit at 410-319-8888. Maybe you studied it in class, maybe you didn't. Or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Baltimore in 1958, as you write about it, was, I forget who the quote was from the book, but I have it marked here somewhere, that was a city of neighborhoods. Donovan said he liked it, or Donovan, because he came to Baltimore, and it was like the Bronx. It was like where he came from. It's a city of ethnic neighborhoods. You didn't cross bounds.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just black-white. It was ethnic. You didn't
Absolutely.
Cross bounds.
You know, the Jews were out in northwest Baltimore. West Baltimore was the blacks. As you moved east, you had the pocket of Little Italy. As you moved towards Highlandtown, you not only had the Eastern European ethnics, but they were divided. You had the Greeks here, the Czechs there, the Poles there, the Germans there. They were – Ted Venatoulis, who grew up there and later became Baltimore County executive, said, you know, when he left his neighborhood of Greeks and walked across the street – to where the Poles or the Germans were, he said that was like crossing an ocean. It was a great dividing line, and you know, there was a mutual suspiciousness, which is where the public schools did such a great service, because they brought kids together.
I mean, you're right that in today's world, 1988, people have a mixed marriage, it's usually across racial lines.
Mm.
But in 58, if you had a mixed marriage, it was like an Irish and Italian getting married.
Well, there were dances. And if an Italian kid asked a Polish girl to dance, you'd have fights that would break out. And at the dance, the only way they could get the fight to stop was by playing the Star Spangled Banner so that everybody would have to stand at attention.
But
the Colts were, in many ways, they were the thing that helped bond us, because we were looking at these tough, brawny guys, and they were working out. You know, one of the people I talked to for this was a fellow named Jim DeWald, who played football at Poly when we were at City. And he said when he was in elementary school, every morning they had the same opening exercises. The salute to the flag, the Our Father, and the Colts marching song. That's the kind of a religion the Colts were.
And the marching band's a story on its own. I mean,
sure. The fact that the Colts left in '84, they were stolen away by Bob Irsay, taken to Indianapolis, and the band with John Zeman as the leader stayed together all those years, 12 years in the wilderness. They were the only pro football band without a team to call its own, and they would play at other teams' halftime, reminding the NFL, you know, poking the eye, hey, we're still here, we still want football. Pay attention to us.
You spend a bunch of time in the book also talking about the players themselves and the different chapters built around the players. And you write about what they were paid. The difference between football in 58 and football in 08 in terms of salaries and why these guys were so tied to a city the way players are not tied to cities today.
Well, you know, we came from the same economy. We were working class, but so were they. I used to play tackle football every day after school over at the Seton Apartments off Liberty Heights Avenue around Rogers. And I remember we're playing one day, and this kid, his name was John LaChapelle. He came over and he said, guess who just moved in? Jack Call, who was a reserve halfback on the Colts, and Joe Campanella, who was a reserve linebacker. And we couldn't get over it. We thought the Colts lived on Mount Olympus. And he said, no, they moved into the Seton Apartments, which were probably $60 a month rent. They came out of the same working class, and they hung out at the same bars and restaurants as we did. A couple of years after 58, the Colts drafted a linebacker out of Duke named Mike Curtis. A lot of people in Baltimore still remember him. He was a ferocious linebacker. I asked him one time what football meant to him, and he said, I need it. He said, if it wasn't for football, I'd be out in the street knocking people down. He was ferocious. But he said, you know what I used to do after every game? He said, I would drive to some neighborhood bar in Baltimore because I knew Colts fans would be there. He said, we were connected at the hip. He said, we were connected at our souls. We loved them just as much as they loved us. And he said, I don't know if you can have that anymore because we were all working class back then. Jim Parker. I once asked Jim Parker, and you and I, you know, we remember Jim not just from playing, but he had the package goods store at Liberty Heights and Garrison Boulevard
for years.
Great guy. And I said to him one time, how is it you stayed in Baltimore after you retired? And he said, I didn't have the money to move back home. They never made big money. And Parker tells the great story in the book where somebody asked him, what's the biggest difference between college ball and pro ball? And he said, when I joined the pros, I had to take a cut in pay. He played for Woody Hayes at Ohio State. He said, Woody Hayes would tell them, look, if you win the game, I'll let the alumni into the locker room after the game. If you lose, I'm not going to let the alumni in. He said the practice was you would go to your locker, leave your helmet there upside down, and go take a long shower. He said when you came back, your helmet would be full of money that the alumni had left there. He said the first time this happened, I immediately went to the trainer and said, I'm going to need a much bigger helmet. So that's the kind of economics we're talking about then. He said, I had to take a cut in pay. And, of course, the other story, which we were talking about earlier, when he joined the Colts and he signed for, I think, $12,500, and Don Kellett, who was the general manager then, handed Parker $1,000 in $1 bills and said, this is just a taste of what you could look forward to. And Parker was sitting there with his wife, who was kicking him under the table, saying, take it, fool, take it.
I mean, think about that for a second. $12,500. I mean, that was a huge salary for a football player.
A rookie.
Yeah.
A rookie.
$12,500.
Artie Donovan, a Hall of Famer, said the most money he ever made in a season was $25,000. Jim Parker, a Hall of Famer, told me the most he ever made in a season was $35,000. You know, once the players discovered how much muscle they really had economically, then it was a whole different ballgame. And now, of course, it's gone way to the other side where they're making a fortune, and we have to pay a fortune to get into a ballgame.
What did it cost to go to a ballgame then?
Six bucks. You know, the game we're talking about, the 58 championship game at Yankee Stadium that changed the sporting culture of America, the top ticket for that game was $10. Super Bowl today, the top ticket goes for about $600.
Michael Lesker is our guest, columnist for the Baltimore Examiner now. Been a columnist in this town for
more than 30 years, yeah.
His latest book is The Colts Baltimore, a city and its love affair in the 1950s, about Baltimore in 1958, about the great game between the New York Giants and the Baltimore Colts. Sudden death was invented. Football was invented then. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com about your remembrances of the city in that period in the era, your questions and thoughts about how the game of football has changed and how sports have changed in America. 410-319-8888 as we talk with Michael Lesker, The Colts Baltimore. Let's focus for a minute on why that game of 1958 was a game, from your perspective and many others, that changed the nature of football, that changed the way we look at the sport and where the sport was then?
Baseball had a hold on our imaginations for a long time. It was called the national pastime. I think television was coming of age then, and I think the marriage. Here was this game that was made for television. I mean, the dimensions of it, this narrow field, the TV camera could focus on it beautifully. They developed all kinds of technology around it where you could isolate players. You could really capture the drama of the moment, the split end leaping into the air gracefully to catch the pass, and the camera isolating the end, showing it in slow motion, showing it over and over. The drama was incomparable. Baseball, you know, we had fun playing baseball. But the fact is, if you were a kid and you were playing baseball and you went out to center field, you were waiting all day for the other guy to hit the ball out to you. There was a built-in drama that built over the course of nine innings. But in football, by the time you're waiting for the guy to hit the ball to you, football has already run off 14 plays, and each play carried a lot of drama within it, whether you were playing it or watching it. I think the dawning of television and pro football was the perfect marriage.
The way you describe people like Lenny Moore and the others who played on the team and how they played that game, I mean, that the it's just – I've forgotten. As you write it so well. I mean,
you
write about the, just the tension of the game and the and how Lenny Moore would, you know, go 73 yards for a touchdown and
well, that's
the way
the other,
he ran and
you know that's the other great game. A lot of the Colts will tell you they think that the greatest game was the game in which the Colts clinched the division championship that allowed them to go to the championship game. They're playing the 49ers of San Francisco. They've got to win this game. They are down 27-7 at the half, and it's just forget it. I mean, it's a freezing cold day in Baltimore, and they get in the locker room, and Weeb Eubank, the Colts coach, writes on the blackboard four touchdowns. Like, that's all you need to do is score four touchdowns in the second half and hold San Francisco scoreless. And they're, you know, that's ridiculous. It can't be done. But somehow they do it, and they come back, and now it's late in the fourth quarter, and they're trailing by 6 points, and Lenny Moore rips off this 75-yard touchdown run that is still unbelievable, the zigging and the zagging. And the whole stadium, it not only erupted, but people poured down onto the sidelines, and then as the game came to a finish, everybody is rushing out onto the field. The players thought they were going to be crushed, but the emotions were just overwhelming, and Lenny Moore had you know, had ripped off this run like nobody had ever seen before.
And he still lives in Baltimore.
And of course, look, Lenny Moore was a great football player. He's become a greater man. Lenny has spent his retirement years, you know, it's I guess about 40 years now. He's been retired, close to it. Helping troubled kids around the Baltimore area. He's 75 years old, still works with them. He has also, his whole career has worked toward better race relations in Baltimore. He's a guy who we should all point to, not only for what he did on the football field, but what he has done for Baltimore through all these years.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more with Michael Esker about his book, The Colts Baltimore. We're going to talk about race in football, race in the city, what took place in the teams, about the gangsters in the streets of those days and who they were and the bookies and how they changed the city as well and changed the politics of this town and more. 1958 in Baltimore, 410-319-8888. We'll be back in just a minute with Michael Esker. Football music of the 1950s. That does sound dated, doesn't it? But it was there, and we're here. We're talking about 1958 in Baltimore. Mike Olesker, 30 years a columnist in this town, News American, Sun Papers, The Examiner. He's touched them all and touched all of us with his writing. His latest book, and he's written a lot of books now, is The Colts Baltimore, A City and Its Love Affair in the 1950s. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Or write to us here at steinershow at gmail.com about your thoughts on that era. And Mike, I have a passage there. You can read anything else you'd like to, but that one page that kind of describes, the couple of paragraphs, Baltimore in the 50s.
You know, we were talking about race before, and, you know, in 1954, we had the decision that integrated the schools. But what that did was set off kind of a chain reaction, because you had not only were the public schools segregated, so were the private schools, so were the Catholic schools. They suddenly, as though they hadn't realized it before, they said, okay, well, we'll integrate also. Maryland Institute was still segregated back then. Goucher, Peabody Institute, the state's attorney's office was all white. The Maryland Bar Association was all white. Downtown movies were still segregated. Municipal swimming pools were still segregated. So the Buddy Dean show was segregated.
Right.
You know, Romper Room came on the air every morning. It was all white kids on it. Let me read a page or so. It was a time when people knew their place in the worst sense of it. Black people and women, too. Women stayed home and raised their children. All fulfillment was supposed to come from this. The Sunday Sun magazine's Curious Camera asked, "Do you think attending classes or lectures would aid the modern housewife?" Mailman Harry Kennedy answered, "Once a person's out of school, I can't see any sense in them attending classes to learn something they should already know." Dental assistant Robert Whitney answered, "The average housewife is too set in her ways to be changed." That was the same Sunday Sun magazine that went through the entire year ignoring black people. The magazine was thick with stories and with dozens of photographs week after week. In October, it ran a feature on the football coach at the all-black University of Maryland Eastern Shore. In November, the magazine ran a feature on Lenny Moore and another on singer Sally Blair. For the entire year, there were no other black people in story or photo in the magazine. It was the summer Ike and Mamie Eisenhower celebrated their 42nd anniversary, and Annette Funicello marked her 15th birthday. Hula hoops were everywhere. Ed Sullivan introduced the Kingston Trio on television and said they were a nice bunch of boys, even though they weren't wearing jackets and ties. James Dean was everybody's idea of a rebel, but against what? We weren't so sure, and he got killed in a car crash before he could tell us. It seemed a cautionary tale to the latent rebel in each of us, and that other great rebel, Marlon Brando, was no clearer. In The Wild Ones, Brando was asked, "What are you rebelling against?" "What do you got?" he replied. The 50s are seen in retrospect as a time of great order and calm. When people turned on their television sets, they saw the perfect middle-class nuclear families on Father Knows Best and Ozzie and Harriet. But in Baltimore, it was beginning to feel like a disconnect. The city was already heavy with families living below the poverty line. 70% of the state's welfare families lived in the city, and so did 80% of its dependent children. That summer, the FBI called Baltimore a national leader in street crime and took note of a growing narcotics problem. In 1958, there were a reported 60,000 drug addicts across America. Half a century later, there would be 60,000 in the city of Baltimore alone.
It was a different time.
A different time.
And you write about that when you were talking about the movie theaters, maybe thinking of the scene you wrote about Lenny Moore.
Yeah.
With his wife, who was much lighter complected than he.
Yes.
Trying to get into a movie theater.
Tried to get in, standing in line, and the woman taking the money said, "She can go in," gesturing toward his wife, "but you can't." And the humiliation that Lenny felt, even though he had been somewhat braced for it. Before Lenny arrived, Buddy Young was the great African-American ball player that white Baltimoreans were watching for the first time. Buddy was retiring when Lenny was coming in, and they used to, well, they practiced up at what we used to call Western Maryland College up in Westminster. And Buddy said to Lenny, you can go to the Twin Kiss ice cream place, but that's it. Don't go down into the town because you'll get thrown out. They won't let you in. But by the time they got to Baltimore, Lenny didn't think that he would come up against that. And then a year later, when the Colts drafted Jim Parker and he heard what had happened to Lenny a year earlier, he considered not coming to Baltimore because he wasn't going to put up with that. Slowly, slowly, the world changed, and these guys were a part of it. They heightened a lot of people's consciousness and consciences.
You see him in your writing in the book, also in the columns you've done over the years, but in your book, to have a romance on a certain level with the old street corner guys of the 50s, the bookies, the guys who ran the numbers, all the names you give them, or they had, I should say.
I like characters. I like street characters. These were guys who were, you know, who were getting locked up a lot for what? For gambling. For something that the state, in its finite wisdom, finally looked at and said, you know, we should get our own cut of this. And they, of course, established the state lottery.
They put the bookies out of business.
Yes. But that's what they were doing. And they were getting locked up over and over again. One of my best friends through the years, and I used to have lunch every Tuesday at Sabatino's restaurant, still go down there quite often. But for 30 years, I had lunch every Tuesday with a bunch of these bookmakers, you know, who were getting locked up regularly for the crime of taking a bet on a three-digit number. One of them was a fellow named Al Izella, who's still around. He's in his 90s. And I still remember the night that Cal Ripken broke Lou Gehrig's record for consecutive games played, and the scoreboard was flashing 2,131. And at that moment, Al Izella's lawyer suddenly came up to me in the ballpark and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "How come they're flashing the number of times Al's been arrested?" It was a mild exaggeration, but these guys were getting arrested all the time for taking bets on numbers. And so I found that kind of endearing, and also they were great, colorful stories. And that's how I make my living, telling stories.
You do. You do it well. And the stories, when you were talking about, one of the things that hit me about the book was thinking about guys who had made their money and power in that era in Prohibition and running numbers,
yeah,
ended up being the political leaders of this town as well.
Well, Mimi DiPietro, you know, was one of Al Izella's best friends. In fact, when one of the times Al had to go off to jail, Mimi and I drove him to Lewisburg Penitentiary. And, you know, to listen to the two of them comparing notes on the world was an education in itself. Mimi started out, he was like a third grade dropout. And got into bookmaking and eventually worked his way into politics and became a city councilman who served for about a quarter of a century. And Mimi, you know, was not an educated man by any stretch. He fractured the English language. He used to talk about when he gave a speech afterwards, he would wait for the crowd to give him a standing ovation. Jimmy Carter was president and came to Baltimore and had lunch at Ciparelli's in Little Italy. And he invited to have lunch with him there William Donald Schaefer, who was mayor at the time, Paul Sarbanes, Mac Mathias, Mimi DiPietro, Tommy D'Alessandro. And here we have the leader of the free world sitting there at lunch. And Mimi DiPietro spent lunch saying to the leader of the free world, "You got to do something about them potholes in East Baltimore." You can't make up stories like that. These were guys. Here's what I hope that people will keep in mind, and that I tried to get into the book when I talked about these characters. These were people who had grown up during the Depression, come of age during the Depression and World War II, had survived that, where they didn't know if they were going to survive, put food on the table, whatever. they did what they could to support themselves and their families. They cut loose a little. They took a bet on a three-digit number, and this was considered a crime. And they said, no, this is how I'm scrounging to make a living, particularly when a lot of these guys had depended on jobs at the places like Sparrows Point, where the jobs were now beginning to dry up in the post-war years.
Let me grab a hold of that book again, Michael, since you've... We'll find some other stuff for you to read. We're talking with Michael Lesker here about Baltimore in 1958. And it was a very different Baltimore than we have right now. It was a city that had almost a million people.
Yeah. We were the sixth or seventh largest city in America. Now we're, what, top 25 maybe?
If we're lucky.
Yeah, we're about 600 and some thousand. We were 950,000. And a lot of that was happening then. A lot of the move to suburbia, which was happening all over the country... But it was happening certainly in profound ways in Baltimore, where just about all of the new housing that was being built in the late 50s, early 60s was happening out in the suburbs.
There's some great pieces about Johnny Unitas. I just want to kind of get a flavor of that person for people who don't know who he is or people who only heard about the legend of this great quarterback.
Here's a guy whose father died when he was 5 years old. His mother scrubbed office floors at night and had a small coal delivery business during the day, and this supported the family. He was a terrific high school quarterback, but was turned down by all the big colleges because they thought he was too skinny and scrawny and wouldn't survive. Went to the University of Louisville, which was a very small school. Got drafted by the Pittsburgh Steelers, mainly because he was a hometown kid. They didn't even give him a chance to play in the preseason game. They cut him. He had no money. He hitchhiked home. He's playing in a semi-pro league for $6 a game.
$6
a game on a field that was littered with broken glass and oil slicks. And the Colts hear about him, and they place an 80-cent phone call. Do you want to come down and try out for the Colts? And he's down here for a couple of games, and the Colts' starting quarterback, George Shaw, gets injured. And they throw Unitas into the game. And sure enough, the first pass he throws, the Bears' J.C. Caroline intercepts and returns all the way for a touchdown. And, you know, pretty devastating. But he hangs in there, and he has a pretty good game. And the next year is voted the most valuable player in the league. And the year after that leads the Colts to this sudden-death championship. I mean, in the most dramatic game ever seen, and here's this kid 2 years off of Sandlot, and he changes the world. I guess on some level, you know, when you lose your father at age five and your mother is scrubbing floors to keep the family together, you realize that there are things that are more important in life than a football game. And whatever happened, you keep your head about you. One of the people that I interviewed for this game was Andy Nelson, who was a defensive back on those teams. Here's the other thing that happened that was so great as a bonding force in Baltimore. They win this game, and the game is over, and we knew that the Colts were going to return to Baltimore that night. 30,000 people. Nobody said, go to the airport and welcome the Colts home. 30,000 people just decided, I'm going to the airport. I want to be there when these guys come home.
Were you there?
I was not there, but we saw it on television. They televised it. This was dramatic, too, because in Baltimore, what do we know from local TV? We had Romper Room and Buddy Dean and Keith McBee delivering the 7:23 news, 7 minutes of airtime to deliver all the news of the world. And suddenly here we see 30,000 people running all over the place on television. And they were, you know, jumping on top of the bus. And there are pictures in the book with this. The Colts thought they were going to be killed. But first, you know, 30,000 people, they're driving to the airport. And within minutes after the game, they started driving there, 1,000 people. 1,000 became 5,000. 5,000 became 10,000. They filled the garage. They filled the parking lot. Now on the radio, announcers are saying, look, if you're going to the airport, don't go. Turn around because there's no room. people are parking their cars on the highway, and they're walking the rest of the way to the airport, and they're standing out there on the tarmac as though waiting to cradle the team's plane as it comes in. The plane lands way out on the tarmac because by now the pilot has heard there are 30,000 people. They put them on these buses. They try to – the driver's trying to separate the crowd like Moses trying to separate the Red Sea. The crowd, they're jumping up on top of the bus. They're jumping on top of police cruisers. They finally manage to get through. They take the players who are so happy to be alive. They get into their cars. And Andy Nelson told me this story that he and John Unitas drive home together. And I said to Nelson, who, of course, still lives here in town, has Andy Nelson's ribs out on York Road in Cockeysville. I said, what was that like? Just the two of you driving in the car. You have changed the world of sports. You have changed the American sporting culture. You have arrived home in Baltimore to 30,000 people adoring you, screaming their lungs out. What was that? Were you, you know, Mark, if it's you and me, we're going, hey, how about this play? How about that play? My God, this is unbelievable. Did you turn on the radio? Were you listening to fans calling in and saying how great? He said, we sat there in silence. He said, we finally get to my house. Neither of us has said a word. I get out of the car at my house. He said, John Unitas turns to me and says, see you tomorrow. And that was it. And I guess maybe that snapshot captures a little bit of Unitas. Throughout everything, the world is erupting in chaos all around him. He's keeping his head. He always did. And he did it at that penultimate moment that changed the world of sports in America.
And you when you write about him... you're talking about this kid in the who was he in the band?
Oh, John Zeman was yeah. John Zeman became the leader of the Colts band years later, and he's the guy who kept the band together. But he gave me some insight. He became very good friends through the years. But he was a kid. He was 15 years old, and he was playing in the Colts band, and he came down. He got very sick with pleurisy. Unitas didn't know him. But he heard about this kid in the band who was out at St. Joe's Hospital, who was real sick. And here's Zeman in the hospital, 15-year-old kid, really sick, can't even lift his head. And a nurse comes in and says, can't believe it. She says, John Unitas is coming up the hallway to see you. And Zeman says, yeah, and so's the Queen of England. And sure enough, a moment later, there's John Unitas standing there with a football in his hand, the game ball from the day before they had beaten the Los Angeles Rams, and stays for 2 hours. And then leaves 4 o'clock that afternoon. 4 hours later, 8 o'clock that night, another nurse comes into Zeman's room and she says, do you know Mr. Unitas is still here? He's been going room to room talking to all of the children who were in the hospital 4 hours later. I think that's the kind of guy Unitas was.
There was a great line that when you talk about John Unitas was walking with another ex-player, I think, and a homeless guy came up to them.
Yeah.
And the other guy was with Unitas was going to give him $10. And the guy never looked at the $10. All he wanted was to talk to John Unitas.
He said, you're John Unitas. A homeless guy, you know, clothes just disheveled, teeth missing, really, you know, sadly down and out. He says, you're John Unitas. And John says, yes, I am. And the guy starts to wipe his hand off to shake John's hand as though his hand isn't clean enough to shake hands with John. And Unitas grabs his hand and shakes it and spends the next 15, 20 minutes just talking to the guy and finally says to him, look, you got to take care of yourself. You got to. And the guy says, yes, sir, I will. And he, you know, he never shook anybody off.
He was told, his line was, God put me on this earth to make people happy.
Late in the game, he began to see just what a towering figure he really was to so many of us.
We're sitting here with Michael Lesker. His latest book is a book called The Colts Baltimore, A City and Its Love Affair in the 1950s. about a game that changed the nature of sports, about a period of time in Baltimore that was changing drastically, about the men who played the game, and the era that some of us lived through. 410-319-8888, or you can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com, and we'll take your calls and your conversations about this great game and this great time, this interesting time in the history of Baltimore. You write about, let's talk about some of the other guys you write about in here, because they were emblematic at the time as well. Well, the two of them were sticking in my head for some reason. One's Big Daddy Lipscomb, and the other is Raymond Berry. It couldn't be more different as two men, but...
Big Daddy Lipscomb was a guy who had a terrible upbringing. He was a kid whose mother was killed standing on a street corner by a boyfriend. Gene Big Daddy Lipscomb, he was a huge guy, 6'6", 288, graduated high school, never went to college, went into the Marines, was discovered playing football in the Marines, joined the Colts, was a very self-conscious guy. That he was the only guy introduced before games as being a high school graduate. You know, they, you know, number 88, you know, from Syracuse, John Mackey, whatever, was always Gene Big Daddy Lipscomb from Miller High. All the other guys on the team would talk about college that they went to, and he couldn't share that experience. Was a phenomenal football player and such a great part of that team. Raymond Berry was a kid who grew up in Texas, became, even though he had a poor eyesight, he had one leg that was shorter than another, but he made himself into the premier wide receiver of his time, and was the guy who kept catching John Unitas's passes in that championship game, three of them on that final drive for the field goal and two more in the overtime. And Raymond, one of the great joys of researching this book was spending time with some of these old guys, including Raymond Berry, who remembered vividly, play by play, what happened in that game and being in his hotel room and reliving that game. The game meant the world to Baltimoreans, but it has stayed with these guys, too. They realize now how they shook up the whole world.
Michael Lesker's with us. Great book, The Colts Baltimore, really worth the read. Reads as well as his stories are told, if not better. 410-319-8888. Bob in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hey, guys, I'm originally from Pittsburgh. 25 years ago, my wife and I moved here. So, you know, Steelers fans, but, you know, I always liked the Colts, and your stories are just wonderful. I mean, they bring tears to my eyes. I'm an old guy, so I just wanted to thank you. I used to read Mike a lot. I haven't seen him lately. I used to listen to Mark a lot. I haven't seen you lately. I really want to thank you for these stories. I mean, they're just wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm glad we could do it today. It's a great book. You'll love this book.
Yes.
It's Michael's a great writer, and this is just great book. 410-319-8888. Appreciate those comments. Russ, in East Baltimore, you're on the air.
Greetings, Mark, to you and Mike. I want to kind of echo the last caller because it's good to see both of you guys back in action.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to talk my favorite United story was we were playing the Detroit Lions. Fourth quarter, they talk now about the two-minute drill. We were down 21-7. We won that game 28-21 against the Yale Larry and the Foyle boys. So
and Detroit had a great defense, too.
That defense and the Foyle boys was something that to throw three touchdowns in 2 minutes, I thought that was fabulous. I just had to get that in.
You know, we used to have a newspaper in town, the News Post, which later became the News American, and I can't count the number of times the headline on Monday afternoon was Miracle on 33rd Street.
That's right.
I remember a lot of them. You know, we used to go in, we didn't have the $6 for a ticket, but we used to get out there to center field fence. When the Birds were playing with the center field fence, but we used to get mother's chicken on Sunday and crawl up under the trees and the pines, and we saw most of it.
That's great. That's
Thanks,
great.
Guys.
Thank you for calling. Thank you so much.
That's what it was back then. I mean, if people are remembering these games like they were yesterday.
Yeah, absolutely. They've stuck in our memories. It was a very special time. We were a city that was beginning to think of ourselves, this municipal inferiority complex, but the Colts really gave us a reason to puff out our chests and say, look what we got here. We got our problems, but this football team really represents us and makes us feel good about ourselves.
But I think it was nice about your book as well is the context of a changing America, yeah. Of talking about who we were.
The other thing I talk about that was a great change back then, rock and roll was coming in. You know, it wasn't just on the Buddy Dean
right.
show, but rock and roll with WCAO was the great rock and roll power in the late 50s. And 1958 was the year they made the changeover. And parents were screaming at children, you know, how can you listen to this? And people didn't have air conditioning back then. And so windows were open. And you could walk down the street and hear rock and roll coming out of one window. And in the same house, out of another window, was a mother yelling at the kids, turn that music down. This was the great changeover. And I tried to talk about that. That's
right. The
windows
had to be open.
That's right, exactly.
Michael Lesker, it's been great to see you. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me, pal.
And thanks for writing the book. Michael Lesker, The Colts Baltimore, well worth a read. It's just a fantastic book. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered this hour by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Judith Floyd, Stavros Halkias, and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.